So the Vedic culture then begins with the Brahmachari ashram. Brahmacharya means is where one is studying actually to understand what is human life. One understands, you know, what is transcendence, how is the process of attaining it. Because from there, then any other position that one will be in society, it's supposed to be for attaining to God consciousness. So then, because what one is having, okay, so then the first element in the Brahmacharya after, you know, how you say, is respect. Because without respect, then no relationship can be established. One can only have a relationship if there's respect for another person. Right? Otherwise, then it will simply fall into the other categories, the 12 secondary rasas. Seven secondary rasas. It can only be primary if there's respect. Shantaras means that there's something that you appreciate about the other person. So that's the basis of relationship. When that appreciation increases, then there's the development of the desire of serving. When the serving deepens, then you get friendship. Friendship deepens, then you have the parental. And parental deepens, you get conjugal. So if there's no respect, you don't have a relationship. Does that make sense? It's that simple.
Can you define respect, Maharaj?
Respect. I would say, you'd have probably active and, you know, passive and active, but basic principle is an appreciation of some quality that the other person has. And then would be the appropriate interaction with that person based on their individuality. Does that make sense? In other words, you're respecting an individual, so that means their individuality must also be considered. So if you're not considering the other's position, then you can't call that respect. Does that make sense? So then, that first is then established by respect for the teacher. Then there's, does that make sense? So one has to be able to respect seniors, work cooperatively with equals, and to be kind to juniors. Then everything becomes established. So that means, you know, respect for the teacher, respect for parents, respect for other relatives, respect for anybody within the whole system, the whole social system. And then ultimately respect for the teacher, respect for the scriptures, respect for God, respect for the devotees. So we can see is that the whole culture will function if there's respect. Someone with no respect doesn't really have a relationship with anybody. Just because there's some interaction doesn't mean there's relationship. It means as far as there being the proper exchange. Yeah, like let's say you have a very famous person. They're appreciated. Okay. So that's Shantaras. So the person is appreciated, it means the person in the audience is appreciating the person on the stage. That's Shantaras. But if the person on the stage doesn't appreciate the persons in the audience, it's not a dynamic relationship. Therefore, that's with why you have so many personalities that were prominent on the stage. Then with time, they find themselves alone because they never actually had a relationship with the audience. So they're alone. You can look at so many very prominent persons, and they die alone, even though hundreds of thousands or millions of people were sitting there and saying, chanting their names or whatever it may be. But the relationship never became dynamic because there was not mutual respect. So respect is the basis of the whole system. Then after that's knowledge. That if one has knowledge, then one can operate the system, one can operate the relationships. Without knowledge, the field of activities can't be you know, how you say, properly engaged. So therefore, spiritual knowledge, material knowledge, whatever knowledge is necessary for the individual to engage themselves properly in Krishna's service. Because the point is to be engaged, body, mind, words, in the Lord's service. If that is there, then one is properly situated. But if not, then there'll be some feeling of lack. So the idea is that all aspects of the personality that are, you know, need to be dealt with to keep one fully engaged, then that kind of knowledge one must have. And having knowledge then means service, right? Service must be performed. Knowledge and service always go together. In the Vedic concept, they're not separated. Brahmachari is a student. But another definition of a brahmachari is one who performs menial service. So that means knowledge and service go together. And that menial service creates humility. Because humility is the first quality of knowledge. Krishna gives the definition of knowledge in the, I think the Gita, I think it's 13.1, I think it is. And then there, he gives 20 items. The first one's humility. So then we see from those definitions that you have qualities of the person, how they would live, how they would think, how they would act. It's said in the Mahabharata that the symptom of knowledge is humility. Right? If someone's not humble, they're actually not knowledgeable. Very different approach, right? The Vedic than the modern. Like that. But if one is knowledgeable, one is humble, that's appreciated. One is approachable, then you can have relationships. Then, naturally, someone who has that knowledge and respect and practice then is clean, right? So then all the aspects of cleanliness, you know, cleanliness of the body, the mind, the words, the environment that you live in. So basically, then that is the training of the brahmachari. So all those qualities have to be carried through into grihastha life. If they're not, grihastha life will not be successful. Because grihastha life is simply the next stage after brahmacharya. Can we do algebra without arithmetic? Possible? Absolutely not possible. So therefore, one can never be a good grihastha without the qualities of a brahmacharya. That's not an opinion. That's not something that you can choose to accept or not. It's just fact. It's just reality. If you don't have respect for the partner, you don't have knowledge about what you're doing, right? You don't have humility. You don't have cleanliness. There's not a chance, you know, of, how do you say? You'll never have a chance that you'll ever be in any way, shape, or form a successful grihastha.
That's simple.
That's why in the Vedic culture, brahmachari training was so essential. And it's the grihasthas that generally would be training the brahmacharis, because they were good brahmacharis. So this idea, well, everyone will get married, so why bother? That is the statement of someone who never was and never will be a grihastha. Does that make sense? That would be like saying, well, you're going to eat, and then with time, then that will be ejected from the body anyway, so why eat? That's the intellectual level that we're dealing with here. Not smart. That means they don't even know what a grihastha is. Grihastha is an ashram in which family life is used as the situation for assisting your spiritual development. Grihamedi is not an ashram. It means where your household life is actually the most important. And then Krishna consciousness, everything else goes around that. Don't make the mistake that Grihamedi means someone who's not a devotee and who's breaking every principle possible and is disgusting, smelly, dirty, funky, and, you know, any other, how you say, colorful words you want to add to the definition. Grihastha and Grihamedi are simply a state of consciousness. That's all. In the Bhagavatam, they're describing the Grihamedi and how, as the date for conception is getting closer, his wife is becoming more and more beautiful to him. That means the date of conception means the date was chosen. The date was chosen means it's Garbhodan Samskar, which was chosen according to astrological calculation. So we're not talking about this gross, disgusting, smelly, dirty, funky person. We're talking about a very pious follower of Vedic culture who's not God conscious. Therefore, one has to be very, very careful in that one's grihastha life is based on these principles of, there's one more principle in Brahmacharya, very important, sense control. Shouldn't have left that one out. So then, because grihastha life, generally it's thought, okay, someone's senses are wild, they should get married, but there is no less application of sense control in the grihastha ashram than in brahmacharya ashram. Because if you're going to live with the family, then that means still the senses have to be controlled. Because the point is senses go much beyond, because anger has to be controlled, frustration has to be controlled, motive passion has to be controlled. Women appreciate passion, not the mode of passion. Passion applied in the mode of goodness, like with knowledge. So is that going to happen without sense control? Think about it. That's the whole point. If you have power and it's projected and controlled, something gets done, right? Right? Cars move, motors go around in circles. That's controlled, focused, calculated power. If there's an explosion, that's generally called destruction. So that a man is powerful, that's appreciated by women, but if that power is not controlled and it's not refined and it's not gentle, it's never appreciated. Down at the pub, you whack your friends on the back and, pour beer all over each other's head. Yeah, hey, you're having a great time. But try that at home, It's good amongst the boys. The boys get together, think they're tough, think they're cool, think this is the way you deal with women. But when they go home, not at all. One could say, no, I knew one girl. She was down at the pub and she could knock it back with the best of them. But that's not with her husband. But husband, completely different story. So in other words, if these qualities aren't there, respect, knowledge, service attitude, sense control, cleanliness, one will never be successful as a brahmachari, one will never be successful as a grihastha. One will never be successful. That's why the training is the same for both. So in the Vedic culture, someone's trained properly as a brahmachari, he is trained as a good grihastha. It's not a separate training. Vedic training is you're dealing with reality. This is what family life is. Do you need that? You get married. You don't need that. You stay a brahmachari. You understand? Training's the same. The knowledge needed is the same. So I'm not sitting around and, brahmachari training is not sitting around trashing women. Women trash women. Men don't trash women. So then if we look at that, then sitting around the tough brahmacharis that, chew on a piece of wood in the morning, and when the women go by, spit on them. So are those men or are those women? You understand? The real brahmacharis are very nice and gentle and humble. They just stay out of the way. The tough, cool, rough and ready brahmacharis, those are just basically going to become third class grihasthas. Right? Just give them a little time. So the basis of the culture is the same. So therefore we can see the foundations for brahmacharya grihastha are the same. Temple life, community life is the same. It's the only difference is what's good for you. Let us say we serve lunch, okay? And we have some soup, we have some bread, we have some salad, okay? Now, do we divide it up? Okay, all those who are eating more salad have to sit on this side of the room. All those who are eating more bread sit over there. Those with more soup sit over here. Those that are soup and bread then will sit outside. And those who are salad and soup then will sit out on the veranda. Do we do that? Would we do that? Would that be considered important? No. So then why would we make such a distinction between temple and community if it's just a matter of what you need to eat more of to actually take care of yourself? But in this, remember, the first quality of knowledge is humility. So just as the community doesn't appreciate that the temple thinks they're superior, the temple doesn't appreciate if the community thinks they're superior. Everybody has their position. Everybody has something that they're able to do nicely for Krishna. And so in this way, then, that respect that we mentioned is there from all sides for each other's position. Temple respects the community for their skills that they're able to add to the Krishna consciousness movement. Community respects the temple devotees because they're able to give full time and not be worried about security and all those other things. So it works very nicely. The temple is there to inspire the community. This concept that only temple, that's Krishna consciousness, anything else is not, that's not reality. Temples are there to inspire. Otherwise, if it was the other way around, then in the Vedic age, there'd only be temples and people living in the temples, and that's all there was. There wouldn't have been any grihasthas, isn't it? Like that. But that's that. You had something.
Regarding humility, it was a very important concept in relationship temple, grihastha community. You see, a Brahmana is a self-realized person. He sees mudita vision to everyone. He's an example of humility. When a gentleman comes to the temple, he welcomes the person to the temple. When a dog comes to the temple, he takes out the dog. Hut! He's not what humility means. How do we understand humility? He's not being humble to the dog.
He's not being humble to the dog.
Although the dog is part and parcel of Krishna.
Yes, that's there.
So what's humility?
What is humility? Humility is, as we mentioned, is the basis of knowledge. So knowledge means that you understand your position, someone else's position. So therefore, one understands the position also of a dog. So the dog is not clean. And they're generally not known for great social behavior dogs. Right? So where the dog can do something nice for Krishna is, you know, protecting and taking prasad. So they'll be kept in that position. You know, it's just like, let's say if someone goes to the toilet without cleaning, he doesn't walk out of the toilet and then does, you know, worships the deity. Since we're engaging the conditioned nature in the Lord's service, the conditioned nature has to be taken into consideration. So the dog's conditioned nature is unfavorable for temple activities. Therefore, then, they don't come in the temple. And if you say, my dear dog, you know, please, you're not clean, you haven't brushed your teeth, taken your bath today, and, you know, so therefore you can't come in the temple, they don't understand, it's not their language. But you say, hut, then they understand, okay, I don't go in here. Like that. So you have to talk someone's language. Does that make sense?
Humility is accepting our position. Humility is accepting our position.
Humility is accepting ours, accepting someone else's, and then acting appropriately.
Shudra respects, you know, the boss, the Vaishya respects money, the Kshatriya respects power, the Brahmana respects knowledge. So different kinds of respect in the same community, different concepts of respect in the same community.
No, all those concepts of respect are common. So wherever that is, that's respected. So skill, fame, age, wealth, influence, knowledge, family relations, how you say, sacrifice or service rendered, these are all positions of respect. So whoever has it, they're respected. And there's a hierarchy of those, and so whoever has either a higher one or more combination or greater volume that has to be judged, then the respect is more or less. So everybody in the Vedic culture is respected. It's just what you're respected for. That's all. I mean, it's just like, let's say, you have a businessman. So the Shudras that work for him respect the Vaishya. But the Vaishya in his dealings respects the Shudras. Just because you respect someone doesn't necessarily mean that they become superior to you. Respect means you acknowledge their individual position and their specific worth as an individual. And that worth is established by God, not by us. In other words, you're dealing with what is the position of the living entity at present. So by the living entity's actions, they put themselves in a particular position today. So every soul has the same nature. But due to their attachments, the modes of nature then have, you know, an interaction with the modes, then they've developed a specific conditioned nature. So you balance between the nature of the soul and the conditioned nature that that soul thinks they are. Let us say a elder Kshatriya meets a younger Brahmin. So the Brahmin will respect the Kshatriya for his power and influence, depending upon how much power and influence he has. If he's a local king, he'll get one level of respect. If he's a greater king and he has so many other kings under him, he'll get more respect. If he's an emperor, he'll get the most respect. And his age will be respected because he's older. But at the same time as the king will respect the Brahmin, because the Brahmin by nature is superior to the Kshatriya. And in Brahmins, it's knowledge that's important. So depending upon his degree of knowledge and realization, then he will be respected. So there'll be mutual respect, like that. That's how then the relationship will work. The king meets a citizen. Yeah. Then depending upon the qualification of the citizen will be respected for that. But at the same time, the citizen respects the king because the king is superior. Does that make sense? So, in other words, the qualities that are respectable are always respected. At the same time, that hierarchy is there, you know. So let us say you have two kings. One is more influential than the other, then the one that has more influence will be respected more than the one with less. Or let's say you have a smaller king that's very influential, and another king that is much more wealthy, then the one will be respected for his wealth, the other one for his influence. Or you have an older Kshatriya and a younger Kshatriya, but the younger Kshatriya happens to be his uncle. So the older one will be respected for their age, but the younger one will be respected for their family relation, right? Or you have two Kshatriyas and one is more powerful and another one has done more sacrifice. So the one with more sacrifice will be seen as superior to the one with more influence. But if someone has more influence and more sacrifice, then that's even better than that. Does that make sense? So, therefore, everybody is respected for whatever quality they have, because opulence is Krishna's, right? The six opulences belong to Krishna, so wherever they're observed, they're respected. The male potency is Krishna, the female potency is non-different from Krishna. That's respected. Krishna is rasa, therefore all the rasas are respected. So that's why, without respect, how would you interact with anything? Because everything's coming from Krishna. Everything has some quality of Krishna. Therefore, without that humility, without that respect, then there is no relationship.
The problem arises when one does not recognize the qualities of the other. It should be a system to train them to recognize
the qualities of the other. Well, that's what Brahmacharya training is. Because you're taught respect, that means you know all the levels of respect. And how to, like we did there, how to judge who's respected for what. So therefore, you have to see what are the qualities to respect, and you also have to see, after adding up everything up, who would be in the more respectable position. Okay. Anything else on this?
If someone is very respectable for certain qualities, but at the same time in the personal relationship there is something which obstructs harmonious relationship, then we keep a distance, or what should be done?
Something that obstructs a harmonious relationship.
Yes, something that prevents the realization of a harmonious relationship when the person is close.
It means like a wall or something?
No, some other qualities the person has very respectable qualities, but at the same time has qualities that we cannot respect and we can't relate to it in a harmonious way.
Right, so you respect those qualities that are respectable and just avoid the others. So unless those qualities have something to do with your specific relationship, then that's left for others to deal with. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but what if these other qualities enter into the relationship?
Enter into the relationship, then you have to see
it. Disturb the relationship.
If you're in a position to do anything about it, or you're just in a position to tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like that. But otherwise, if it's too disturbing, then the relationship becomes less close, it'll become more formal. But the concept that unless someone is 100%, you can't respect, that doesn't, in practical life, work. You've just taken the pot off the fire. It's very hot. Do you respect that hotness? Right?
Yes.
Let us say the pot's been off the fire for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
It's not absolutely hot, but it's still hot enough to burn you. Is that hotness in the pot respected?
Yeah. Yes.
So that means any quality that's there has to be respected. It doesn't matter what other qualities are there. Prahlad Maharaj respected his father by age and by relationship and by influence. He didn't say, well, you're just the biggest demon. Well, you could call him a big demon, but, you know, but that was out of respect. Oh, best of the demons. Oh, that's my son. Because they're known as demons, right? You know, right? You know, like these rough, tough guys outside with their funny hair and black outfits and, you know, all kinds of, you know, how you say? You know, if they were on a bridge, you would understand all the rivets, but since they're not a bridge, then they're sometimes wondering about all the various, you know, metallic pieces that are poked through various parts of their body. But, you know, they're bad and nasty, but you have to respect their influence. Right? And you respect that by walking on the other side of the street. Or better yet, go around the block the other side. Because that person, due to his conditioned nature, he feels that that street is his. So you respect that, and you walk around.
I have problems with respecting devotees, and I asked the advice of one of my seniors, and he told me that in order to be able to respect devotees, you have to be close enough and you have to be distanciated enough to be able to respect them. And could you, so you have to be close and at the same time you have to keep a distance. So could you elaborate on that?
Close means is that you see what is there. Okay. What would you consider to be intelligent? Someone who practices spiritual life or someone who doesn't?
The one who practices spiritual life.
Of those who practice spiritual life, would you consider the one who simply understands Brahman to be superior, or one that understands Bhagavan?
The one who understands Bhagavan.
Okay, so of those who understand Bhagavan, then which would be better, one who understands or one who actually practices what he understands?
The second one, who acts upon.
Okay, so now taking that, how many such persons are there in the world? There's 6 billion people on the planet. How many actually do that?
Not very much, not very many.
So what's not to respect?
He understands by intelligence that they are respectable, but in his actions and in his behavior, he is not able to show the proper respect towards these personalities.
And why not? Okay. What do you find not respectable in the devotees?
Mostly qualities that that I myself have also, and which kind of present the problem in the performance of our spiritual lives.
Bingo. In other words, You have qualities that you yourself can't respect, therefore you can't respect anyone else. So unless you respect yourself, how are you going to respect others? So unless you like being alone, then you should work on this. Does that make sense? Who are you? What qualities you can do? What is your nature? What service you can render? Have you ever analyzed that?
I've tried.
Okay, so then why can't you do that for others?
So because it's easy for me to see bad qualities in myself, it's easy to depict them in others, and as much as they disturb me in myself.
That's your bad qualities, but I said good qualities. Never tried that? See good qualities in yourself, what you can do. Bad's easy. You just walk out this gate, stop someone who just walks by, and ask them, what's the problem with the Hare Krishnas? Easy. To find good qualities, that's harder. Okay? Now here, look at this. You're able to see bad qualities in yourself. Right? That gives you a skill to see bad qualities. Right? Therefore, you can see them in others. Okay? But, so now, if you can see what qualities you have and how to engage them in Krishna's service, you'll be able to see that in others also. Does that make sense?
So that means that the real self-appreciation helps appreciating others too?
I like that. If you're happy, you deal with others how?
In a positive way.
And if you had a bad hair day, then how do you deal with everybody else?
Not in a not so positive way.
You understand? This is direct, it's science. You know what I'm saying? It's not some unknowable or esoteric thing. It's very, very direct. Nectar devotion is called the science of devotional service. It's a direct science. So as long as you're always, bothering yourself about yourself, then you're going to bother everybody else also, because that's all you know how to do. But the point is those qualities are Krishna's. They're not yours. So that means you can't claim them in the positive or in the negative. You can't say, yes, I'm so great, but you can't say, oh, I'm so terrible. Does that make sense? So you just have to have a little bit more positive outlook. You know what I'm saying? That doesn't mean that one's not intelligent and analyzes properly and not able to see fault. But fault is looked at in relationship or from the perspective of how to properly progress. Let's say you fell in a mud puddle and you get out of the mud puddle. Then you look at yourself and you analyze that you're covered from head to foot in mud. So then what would be the proper application of that observation that you're covered from head to foot in mud? Start lamenting, oh, I'm covered in mud and I'm so useless, and then, you know, fall on the ground and roll around and like that? Or go, wow, I'm covered with mud, and then go and take a bath?
The second one.
So like that. Otherwise, oh, I'm all covered in mud and rolling on the ground, and you see someone else, oh, he's also got some mud on his shoe, and oh, the whole world's just mud, and everything's terrible, right? The opposite of mud is clean. And a clean person will appreciate other people that are clean. At the same time, if they do observe any mud, they know how to get rid of it. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
The person who's dirty, complaining he's dirty and complaining everyone else is dirty, of what benefit is that for anyone? But the person who was dirty has made himself clean, now is clean, is able to appreciate cleanliness, and knows how to get rid of dirt. That's useful. That makes sense?
So he's read in, just in this connection, he's read in one of Sutra Maharaj's lectures that the root of many problems among devotees is a low self-esteem, and but at the same time we see that in our scriptures that advanced devotees, that the symptom of an advanced devotee is that he thinks himself very fallen and very, very unimportant, and so how can we understand these two things?
Low self-esteem, what does that mean?
We think ourselves bad.
But what are you comparing bad to?
Compared to what I would like to be.
That's the difference. Humility is, I'm fallen, and that's my position. low self-esteem is, I should be great, worshipped by everyone, but I'm not. You understand? Low self-esteem is simply the opposite of great self-esteem. You understand? Humility is knowledge. I know who I am. Or the other one, you don't know who you are, it's what you would like to be. But not what I'd like to be, meaning that this is a standard, or this is my duty, or this is my actual position. It's simply sentiment, it's the mind. So humility is based on intelligence. Low self-esteem is a experience of the mind. You understand the difference? So humility is realized or understood. Low self-esteem is felt. Does that make sense? Yeah?
To what extent the brahmachari is supposed to take part in leadership or in administration? Because the brahmachari is supposed to learn, and to what extent can he take part in leadership?
Brahmachari is supposed to learn. So how much should he be involved? So the point is service must be rendered with the knowledge one's learning. So if administration or management is a practical application of his knowledge, then it can be used. You know, but it's just within an environment that's, you know, good as a brahmachari. Because service must be rendered. Yeah. Otherwise, how you'll realize the knowledge. But at the same time, as one is willing to do menial service. So even if he was doing administration, one can still do menial service. It just may not be, I say, practical, because there's so many things to do, so someone else is doing the menial service. But it's not that you yourself would not be willing to do it. If you're not willing to do, then one's not a brahmachari. It doesn't make you a grihastha, it just means you're not a brahmachari. Because a grihastha has to work. Lazy grihasthas don't last. But the difference is, if you're not willing to work for Krishna, or be humble and, you know, do that menial service to Krishna, then due to attachment to a woman, the woman will force you to develop the same qualities of humility and service. They have their ways. Yeah, and saying the temple commander could never dream these up. Women are much more expert. Settle means they take your emotions, tie them in a knot, cut them into little pieces, and then, you know, if you haven't learned by then they start, you know, roasting them in the pot, in a pan. After that, then they're nice and hard, then you can pulverize them into powder. Like that. They have unlimited methods. So you will learn to be humble. You will learn to serve. So if you've already learned as a brahmachari, then it makes grihastha life so much easier. And if you've already learned as a brahmachari, then if one wants, one can maintain brahmachari. In other words, all the qualities needed to be a grihastha, you need to be a brahmachari. Varnashram is just 8 different applications to the same thing. A human being is trying to go back to Godhead. And you have 8 different positions in which you can make that endeavor, depending upon what state your conditioned nature is in and your particular identification with it. So there's not that there's brahmacharis and there's grihasthas. No, there's devotees. And of those, some follow the path of brahmacharya to perfect themselves, some follow the path of grihastha to perfect themselves. But the brahmacharya is the basis of the 4 ashrams. It means you have to be a good brahmachari to be a good grihastha. You have to be a good brahmachari to be a good vanaprastha or sannyas. Therefore, it's the basis. So if you can't do that, you can't do it any of the other 3 either, really. Does that make sense?
Question for me. Can
you
take one last question?
Oh, okay, on the same thing.
So, a pragmatic question. You already mentioned mutual respect and cooperation, but it's already based on the concept of the Varna society. You have to know who is who am I, who is he, so we know how to interrelate. Hypothetically speaking, a community which doesn't have this brahmachari training, someone just jumps to the grihastha ashram because of some other reason, we don't respect each other, the temple does, hypothetically speaking, the temple does not respect you. Grihastha doesn't respect the temple authority. Varna Sankara, considering the point, part of Varna Sankara, what's the pragmatic advice, practical advice for the situation?
The whole thing starts with that we said before, that humility and knowledge. Buddhi yoga means using your intelligence and then accordingly situating yourself in what's the best position for you to advance at the present time. So since any position within Varnashram is actually a different flavor of the same thing, whatever is to be learned can be learned in any of them. It just is easier to learn as a brahmacharya because there's no responsibilities, no distractions. So you can focus on that knowledge and, you know, simple application. But even when it's in a more complex situation, it doesn't matter. It means one can still apply it, and, you know, it may take time, but it can be done. Yeah, so wherever one, that's why we always talk about where you are at present. You just take that, and then what's the best way to make that Krishna conscious?
A group is an
assembly of individuals. So if the individual doesn't know who they are, how do you actually have a group? So the point is one has to understand who one is. So that's how you start with the knowledge. And you just work by what's going on at present. Does that make sense?
Do we have seminars on Varna psychology with the body?
Varna psychology, it's the same thing. Varna, okay, here's Varna understanding. A 30-second seminar, okay? Ready?
Go.
Are you leading the community by generating economics? By your endeavor, you're generating them. Okay, that's one. Are you a leader in such a way that you're administering things that you created as a safe and protected environment in which others then can perform their prescribed duties? You know what I'm saying? For the whole community, not your family.
The
personal question, potentially
I
have, but I don't do that.
Okay. Are you leading the community through study and education?
Hungarian is very difficult
language. Okay. But I'm just saying that's the third.
That is a harmony.
If you're not doing that, then that means you're in a position where you're assisting one of those three. Seminar finished. Do you understand? It's that simple. You're either generating money, creating the environment in which money can be generated, training everyone in the society, or you're working for one of those three. There's not a fifth option. So understanding where you fit in Varnashram, that's very easy.
Yes.
Accepting it, that's not so easy.
But humility.
Yeah, because humility is knowledge. Yeah. So it's like this. If in the present situation you work for somebody, in that work you perform the duties of a Shudra. Exactly. Let us say you have a boss and he's hired somebody. Now, if somebody follows these four qualities, which boss would not be happy with them?
Someone follows these four qualities?
Yes, we will list the four qualities.
Okay.
You are a well-wisher of whoever is leading the company and the company itself. You endeavor to perform the duties that are beneficial for that company. You are respectful and cooperative with everybody else in the company or connected in any way to the company or the boss. And whatever is the mood that the company itself is trying to project, you take on that mood when you're doing those duties. Will you be successful as a Shudra or not? And yes. Yeah, and if what boss would not be looking for such a Shudra. So those four qualities are the qualities of a Shudra, a Brahmachari, a devotee, and a woman. Right? So if any of those follow that, they will always be successful. Right? So that's the point. If I'm working for somebody, I behave like this. Then I'm following Krishna's rules on that. Otherwise, it's, okay, I have a job outside. How does that connect to Krishna? This is one of the ways how it connects. So then who are you actually working for? right? You're working for God. Because God says this is how a Shudra does a job. Yeah. So spiritually, you're not compromised. Socially, maybe, because, you know, the boss may not be a great devotee, so therefore, how do you say, there may be so many material compromises, but it's only on the material platform, which is basically illusory. Annoying, but illusory. But devotionally, one's not compromised. You need the same qualities to be a good devotee anyway, because you're going to have those same qualities towards Krishna, towards Guru, towards the Vaishnavas. So therefore, it's not a problem at being in a position, economically being in the position of a Shudra. But whether one's a Shudra or not, that doesn't apply within ashram. Because ashram is spiritual consideration. Varna is social. So in ashram, then it doesn't matter. You know, if one's the Shudra or one's the Brahmin, it doesn't matter. You just engage yourself in those devotional activities that you're most comfortable in and get the, you know, the best results from. You know what I'm saying? So maybe you'd have a Brahmin devotee, they would be comfortable doing puja all day. And someone who is a Shudra by nature, not by necessity, then maybe comfortable or happy to do artik here and there or something like that. They want to be involved, but not necessarily as an occupation. But there's no reason that the person who is a Shudra can't. And so then those qualities of the Shudra, as they advance, those become the qualities. It's the same qualities, right, that we mentioned as a devotee or of a Shudra. So in the beginning, it maybe is coming more from the Shudra platform as the inspiration, but with time, it comes from the devotee platform. So you may find with time that Shudra devotee can be a full-time Pajari, because that's devotional. They may never become a Sanskrit scholar, but they can become, do all the brahminical duties that are connected with devotion. Maybe not academics. So in other words, they skip from the Shudra to Vaishnava. And that's why you see, like in the Bhagavatam, it mentions that, you know, I think it's about Prithumars, I think it's him. Whoever reads this story, if they're a Shudra, then they'll become a great devotee. So see, it's the principles behind it that one has to work with. Then one can always apply Varnashram. Details, that's secondary. Yudhishthira is a king, whether he's wearing a crown or whether he's wearing birch bark. So it's not because you have a crown and a sword that therefore you're a Kshatriya. Kshatriya is an attitude in which you protect and create an environment in which all the other three Varnas can perform their duties. The essential quality that always is there that makes a Kshatriya is protection. A Brahmin, it's knowledge and teaching. A Vaishya, it is generating economics and giving in charity. And a Shudra is assisting the others without bad feelings.
Brahmana
can take the position of leading. A Brahmin is a leader. Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishyas are leaders.
Administration.
If they want. Means Brahmins also function in the administration as ministers.
Advising,
but also taking up managerial, they take up portfolios. But they're not the one that makes the decision. The one that makes the decision is the king. So technically a minister could be anything. In other words, who are the 9 most qualified people in that area of administration in your kingdom? They're the minister. So they may be from any varna. Generally, they'd always be Brahmins, sometimes Kshatriyas, rarely, but sometimes Shudras. Like Vidura, they just have to come from, you know, good background, good qualification, good character, trustworthy, like that. Rules are given. Generally, they're from noble families. So Vidura was from a noble family. He just happened to be a Shudra within that noble family.
You mentioned the importance of practice. How can men and women practice how to behave properly with each other? How can it be carried out in practice? Should there be someone to supervise this, or how to practice this nice behavior? And how could they avoid to commit mistakes? Because mistakes always cause problems.
A mistake causes a problem. That means something's going on. So that means the practice is already happening. So the problem's not the practice. The problem is the knowledge that you should be practicing. You understand? You're practicing something now. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But you have to have the knowledge what to practice. So that's there. It means if you want to get into that, you have to ask a specific question. Because if I come in from the philosophy, it may be too much, and then no one asks any questions. I had that happen once.
So we don't yet have the necessary knowledge, but we have to practice in the meantime to get the necessary knowledge, and how can we know how to practice in the meantime?
It means you have to get the knowledge. The point is you're practicing some things. So take one of those that you have a doubt about and ask a question on it. Yeah?
So the question was that you mentioned that humility and respect is direct science, and if we, but somehow we feel that if we just leave our relationships, we react spontaneously and instinctively and on a sentimental basis, and how can we improve this scientific knowledge or scientific application of these principles of respect and humility, so that we apply them in a scientific way and not just emotionally or instinctively?
Contemplation. You have to think about it. In other words, if there's a situation that came up and you felt those qualities were lacking, then think about it. How better should it have been applied? Yeah? And then next time you try again. So it may take a while before your contemplation bears fruit, but it eventually will if you consistently always contemplate how more properly it should have been done. Right? You don't contemplate, oh, I did it wrong. You contemplate, how should I have done it right? Does that work?
So it's going back to what you mentioned in connection with the deepening of relationships. You mentioned that if the service relationship deepens, it becomes a friendship relationship, and then if it deepens, it becomes parental and then conjugal. But in material life, we don't see that friends become parents and parents become lovers. So how does it manifest in the material platform?
It's deepening. It's just what's showing. That example is given a relationship with the soul's attraction to Krishna. But what the point it means is that within each higher ras, the lower ones exist. Conjugal intimacy is understood. But the parental relationship within the conjugal rasa means where one partner or the other is either physically or emotionally taking care of the other one when they have a problem.
So probably
a husband and wife make plans as friends. They assist and serve each other. But that's all based on that they have an appreciation for each other. They don't appreciate, the other four don't happen. So if you wonder why the relationship's not working, you have to check, do you actually even appreciate the other person? If you do, it'll work.
Okay,
if you don't, it can't work. So that was the application of that. Right? Now, otherwise, sometimes you see a boy and girl live next door to each other, grew up together, went to the school, and eventually they get married. I know one couple that they knew each other since they were 5 and 6 years old. And now they're in their 50s, so they've been together for a while. You know, but they didn't get married, I think, till college. You know, so that's how you can look at that.
That's not
the point that we were making. The point means is that each higher rasa contains the lower ones. Therefore, if in the conjugal rasa there's only conjugal activities, and you're not supporting the other person, are a companion with the other person, serving the other person, appreciating the other person, it doesn't last. Does that make sense? Something else. Potentially break. Now or after some time?
Yeah. We can have a break now.
Okay, we'll take a few minute break and then we'll start again.
It's like this.
If you want to get into discussion, we discussed the brahmacharya ashram, it's very straightforward. You want to discuss the grihastha ashram, I got to have questions. It's the little points that drive you nuts. Ask those questions. So I start off with the philosophy of what the grihastha ashram is based on, then sometimes it's so overwhelming, there are no questions. I tried it once and it failed miserably. So you start with a question. There's so many basic principles. We'll start with anything, anywhere. It will lead to the other because they're all connected. Like, just to throw out a few. So you understand what we're talking about. But you've got to ask them. Why do women have to create an argument? Why is it they're not satisfied with the result of an activity? Why is it I've done so much for them, they don't seem to respond? Or if they respond, it seems very less than what I put into it. Why do they get angry so easily just at a wrong word or a wrong tone of voice? Why is it at the moment when everything's going perfect, that's when they start the fight? Why is it no matter what I say or do, when a fight started, it just gets worse? These are questions you could ask. Yeah, this is what we're talking about. Okay, so we'll stop for a few minutes.